Hello and welcome to this episode of Galactic Chat. I'm Helen Stubbs and I'm interviewing Melbourne-based science fiction writer Lynn C. I recently read her book Nil by Mouth, published by Satellite, and I loved it. How are you going, Lynn?
I'm fine. Nervous, but fine.
Don't be nervous. I'm not scary. We're not scary.
Too far away to bite.
Yeah, no, I won't bite. Now, Nil by Mouth tells the story of Ale, who is a hotelier who becomes enslaved and embroiled in an alien invasion. He's seen as a traitor by humans as he becomes more loyal to his mistress and masters in a similar way to hostages experiencing Stockholm Syndrome. Can you describe your inspiration for the novel and talk about your process of writing it?
It's really difficult to pinpoint any sort of simple series of events that could be described as an inspiration. Every novel I write pulls in details and ideas from, you know, a wealth of life. I'm not a spring chicken any longer. I've got quite a lifetime of experience behind me. And, you know, both my experiences and stuff I've actually read, because, you know, people write about their life too. And as for the process of writing, I can't actually remember what triggered this particular one. I don't remember what triggered any of them, because what actually happens is I get the idea in my head and I carry it around daydreaming about it, dreaming about it, trying this scenario and that in my head and getting to know the characters. And eventually, you know, if it sticks, if it stays, if I can get it going from, you know, woe to go and actually get a story out of it, then I'll start writing. By the time I've done that, it's the protagonist's story. I'm just the narrator. You know, sometimes they'll change the story as we've sort of set on. And again, we'll go through that same process again, you know, metaphysically dialoguing scenarios, trying this and that, until we get something we're happy with, and then I put it to paper.
But, so it's kind of teamwork with your protagonists.
Yes.
Okay.
It's their life I'm writing about.
Yeah. And so Ale would have been your co-writer for this.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that didn't end up in Nil by Mouth, like the backstory of him growing up with his family and the traumas that they went through. But it colours the way he behaves.
Interesting.
It wasn't necessary in the story itself.
Yeah.
But it makes him the person he is.
Well, tell us a bit of his background, if you'd like to. Did an editor take that out, or did you choose to take that out?
It's not to write it. There
you
is some.
Not to write it yet.
I put enough in there to let the reader know. You know, I didn't sort of go blow by blow with his last interview with his father, for instance, because it wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
But I did daydream it.
Interesting. Cool. So the reproductive functions of the three types of aliens in Nil by Mouth create a very different set of cross-species relationships, and it allows exploration of gender and reproductive roles, including the carrying of young internally. Was exploration of gender and reproductive process an important part of writing the narrative?
It's something I've always been interested in, you know, the effect that different gender roles have. I grew up in a household with a single female at the head because our father walked out. She was really strong, and of course she did everything. So I grew up knowing that men didn't do this. Women could do it too.
Yeah.
And women didn't do this because everybody in the house had to do it. So I grew up knowing that gender roles weren't fixed. And so, you know, When you're sort of writing about people you've never met before, you sort of do ask yourself, you know, what does this mean about, you know, species continuation, the physical characteristics, what does it mean in terms of allowing the species to continue as a species? You know, what impact does it have on the way they're going to bring up their kids?
Yeah.
What impact will it mean to their outlook on life? You know, if it's we're a very binary society because we have male, female, and we start life thinking in binary.
Yeah. When it's not really true, obviously, is it? It's,
yes. Well, I know. When you quilt bag, you end up with lots of genders. So you think about the overall impact on societal structures and this is something I've been exploring pretty well all my life.
And that's one of the things that's so interesting about the novel, I think, and so different, is that it does shake up those binary gender norms and says, it really makes you think about it, like where reproduction and gender fit together and how they can be very flexible. Really?
Yeah. Yes. So, am I allowed to talk about what's actually in the novel?
Yeah. So,
considered too much of a spoiler.
Yeah, that's fine. Go for it. I've read it.
Yes.
Yes, other people, if you haven't read it, you have the chance to switch off now and go and read Mill by Mouth by Lindsay. Otherwise, keep listening.
We'll tell you when the spoiler alert finishes.
Yeah.
Because, you think about how skeletal, how thin the ship people are. There's absolutely no way they could ever carry their babies internally.
Yeah.
They end up being the seed carriers, the sperm.
Would you characterise that as a masculine sort of trait or neither? Or
neither.
Something? Yeah, neither.
I don't see the sperm. I look at the seahorse.
Yeah.
The seahorse. Sperm is one of the ways,
Yeah.
You have she oaks and he oaks, but,
Yeah. So the ship people, very slender. They have nowhere to carry babies. They provide the sperm. And then
sperm. And their counterpart, the generals people, they're huge and very solidly built, but they're soldiers. Yeah. You don't want carrying a baby onto the front line.
No.
So they have to have, they may start off the baby, they may provide the egg and start the baby, but very rapidly they need to find another repository for the baby.
Right.
And that's where the carers come in, Drandus people. They're carers. They're not actually the same species, so they've kept their own reproductive methods. But because of what they are, certain individuals are prepared to do the caring role for the generals people.
And it's not pleasant, is it, the carrying of the generals?
They're better for it than humans.
Than humans,
Than humans.
Okay.
Because they've had generations of doing it. It's something they expect.
Right.
In every batch, two or three will be prepared to be carers and carriers rather than some other role. It's just, it's just one of the many, I suppose, careers available to them.
Right.
In Vranda's case, she's sorry about it because it means she can't have her own children.
Yeah.
She's not usual in this. Most of the carers and the carers who look after Ale while he's incarcerated, they're quite happy with their role as carriers.
Yeah.
And they resent the fact that somebody, a human being, is taking that role away from them because they see this as an important function in their usefulness. So they actually resent him. In Duranda's case, yes, she did want children, and so she is sorry to have lost it.
Yeah.
And this is something Ale can identify with, and this is the first step in their healing their relationship.
I love their relationship. I don't know why. it's an interesting relationship between Ale and Duranda. And so did those separate species all come from separate parts of the galaxy or from the same planet? Yeah, because there seems to be a sense of intergalactic.
Yeah, the ship people, their ships, they just travel the galaxy. They go from planet to planet to planet, and that's their life.
Yeah.
The ship people themselves don't ever need to land. They can survive in space for generations.
Yeah.
But the generals people, they like, their body is built for atmosphere.
Right.
Built for what do you call it? Gravity.
Right.
And they also, they need the solidity every now and again. And we have this problem on the space station.
Yeah.
If they exercise very strenuously, they lose muscle mass and their bones become brittle. So every now and again, they have to land on a planet.
I think if I was in a spaceship, if I was in a spaceship, I would want to land on a planet and go for a run around.
It depends what you're built for.
And meet some people. It must be nice meeting people. I've sort of asked about this, but Aiel's relationship to Dranda is complex. It seems loving yet abusive, yet against the backdrop of harsher punishments, it seems quite gentle. So how would you describe their relationship, and is it a metaphor for human domestic relationships?
As I said earlier, Aiel's experience has grown up with, you know, with the attempted suicide of his sister, his brother falling and dying in front of him, which is mentioned in the book. But the trauma that the family goes through trying to deal with Rachel after the event, these things have made him a much more gentle, sort of caring and compassionate person than a lot of other people. Unless you go through these things, and he went through them quite early because he was quite young when Rachel attempted to suicide. And he was fond of her. He was fond of his brother. He was fond of his twin. These things, they change a person. But they also shut him down. He was capable of seeing and understanding. He was capable of empathy, but he wasn't capable of connections.
So he was sort of isolated?
Dispassionate, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Insulated, like some of us, yeah.
And, you know, when he starts seeing the things that Dranda and he have in common, yes, you know, Dranda starts out as his boss. I wouldn't call him her mistress, but she starts out as his overseer.
Yeah.
And then he starts seeing below the surface exterior. And he starts seeing that, you know, she's been brutalized too. Yeah. She was born a carer. Her role in life should have been nurturing and caring.
Yeah.
But she's been taught to punish, to hurt, functions that should have been used to heal have been twisted to pain.
Yeah.
And she can't break that mold of conditioning. She can't, you know, she could no more stop obeying than she could stop breathing. But he was able to see below this. He was able to see that, you know, she needed help too.
Yeah.
And he was able to sort of help her understand herself and grow in herself, grow in her caring, grow in the way she treats the other humans. Because, you know, when she hurts him in front of the other humans, and it's just a passing blow sort of thing. It wasn't meant to really seriously hurt him. It was just telling him off. And she sees that reflected, the human's reaction to that.
The damage, sort of, trust.
Yeah. And, you know, he is able to help her understand that she doesn't have to do that. She can be different. She can be what she is, a caring, nurturing soul.
And I guess in that sense he's sharing humanity, like those great human virtues of compassion and and she learns.
I just hate to call them human. I found it really hard because we have words like humane and humanity, as you said.
Yeah.
But she's an alien.
Yeah.
And she shares these characteristics. She's capable of these characteristics.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. The other interesting thing is the intergenerational punishments, isn't it? There's the threat there of that the
upwards and downwards.
Yeah.
It might not be Dranda's kids, but her brother's kids would be punished if Dranda misbehaved or Dragor misbehaved. Dragor's children would be punished.
Yeah.
And you know they are the same batch.
Yeah.
So his kids are as close to her as they are to him.
Yeah.
And her parents, you know, I've posited that the Earth is a couple of generations at least away from the nearest occupied planet.
Right.
But the last planet they visited, sort of thing. You know, yep. Multi-generational gap.
Yeah.
So she actually grew up knowing her parents.
Right.
Whereas normally what would happen was the parents would be left behind and the children would be taken away.
I see. Cool. Now, who are your favourite authors and which authors have influenced your style?
I got a really long list of favourite authors.
That's good.
So I'm not really sure how to answer this. Yeah, I've been reading science fiction and fantasy since I was very young, since I could read.
Yeah.
That's been the main things I've been reading, but it started even before then, you know, when my mother read Winnie the Pooh and Wind in the Willows, which I still love.
Yeah.
And I read it to my kids over and over again. Yeah. Very poetic and very fantastical and, you know, it's a beautiful story to read to children.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it started when I was very young, very young. And, you know, I started writing my own stuff before I could spell.
You know, yeah.
My first poem was sort of full of spelling errors, which my mother sort of sat down and happily corrected for me.
And was that sort of speculative fiction too or not?
That was a poem about flying cats.
Ah, so there you go. That's speculative fiction too.
Six, and, you know, Ursula Le Guin's Cat Wings wasn't written for another 40 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was hardly an influence, even though, you know, Ursula Le Guin is a favourite author.
Yeah.
It was hardly an influence at that time. It was. Yeah. It just comes out of my own head. It, you know, the stories borrow events from my life,
yeah.
You know, the reactions that people have to specific events are usually borrowed from something I have seen or heard or read about in my own life. But it's like the story about my, it's like the question about my inspirations.
Yeah.
It's not any single person or event or, you know, I mean, I have over 7,000 science fiction books in there.
Really? Wow.
So, you know, which one was, you know, and what was influencing me when I was six? Because, you know, I hadn't read any stories about flying cats at that stage. It was just something I dreamt up.
Okay. In your first publication, was it a fairly young age too? Did you say that?
Published in the school newsletter.
Yeah.
So, you know, at 6 years old, that's about as close as you can get to publication.
That's pretty good.
So.
Awesome. Now, in your acknowledgements, you mentioned the moral support of your late husband and your writing group, Alternate Worlds. Could you tell us about how they helped you?
Well, Clive and I got together. I think we were 25. We're similar age, 4 months apart. We were 25 when we got together at university. And he was at that time, I think, the newsletter editor of the Melbourne Uni Science Fiction Association. And I was editing their journal, which was story writing. You know, the journal had fiction and stuff in it. And
so two editors.
Yes, two editors. Two editors, two database administrators, two science fiction readers.
Why did you get along so well? I can have a lot in common.
It's interesting you say that because a lot of our friends and family thought we were a mixed marriage because, you know, he was hard science fiction. I was more of the soft fantasy type stuff.
Yeah.
He was heavily into rock and roll. I was into classical music. I'm a Christian. He was even to the time he died, he refused to acknowledge that God exists.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people consider this a mixed marriage. But,
yeah. Yeah. But you had science fiction.
We had a lot in common when it comes to the important things in life.
Yeah.
Important values, you know, when we were talking about bringing up our kids, we both wanted the same things for them. We both had the same idea about how to go about getting it. You know, we never had an argument about bringing up the children.
Yeah.
We always agreed totally with each other.
Oh, can't imagine that.
Well,
great.
We didn't have easy kids.
Yeah. Neither do I.
No. But we always agreed on what was best for the children.
Yeah.
That really cements a relationship. When the things that matter to you matter in the same way to the person that's important to you.
And was he supportive of your writing?
He tried to be. As I said, we didn't have an easy time of it with the kids.
Yeah.
Both full-time workers were both, and the kids required a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I loved them to bits, and they're now adults. But
yeah.
I still love them to bits. But they weren't easy. But when he could, he would, just take the kids for a couple of hours off my hands and sort of say, forget the housework, forget this, forget everything, sit and write.
Lovely.
And so I would do that.
Hear that, partners of writers out there? That's what you should do. And did you give him writing time too?
He wasn't creative? Interested in it.
Okay.
What he was doing as the editor of the Melbourne Uni newsletter was because someone had to do it.
Right, okay.
And Clive was the sort of person who stepped up and said, all right, I'll do it, to things like that. He wasn't a writer as such.
Did he edit your work for you?
He tried to.
But you had different...
If you only do 2 hours once every month, there's not a lot to read. I didn't actually finish anything while he was alive. I didn't, and the few short stories I entered into competitions didn't win anything.
Yeah.
And, when you're only doing a couple of hours, you shoot off a short story in 2 hours, it's not really all that good quality, and I have to admit reading them later. But he tried, and I first started writing Neil by mouth after he died. So he never saw any of it. Ale is partly him.
And would you describe Neil by mouth as hard sci-fi? Because you said you were more of a soft fantasy.
It has the hard sci-fi tropes.
Mm.
But it's like, I suppose it's like Ursula Le Guin's hard sci-fi. It's heavily based upon the interactions of the humans, aliens, of the characters.
So there's a strong social exploration element there.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
And what about...
The hard science fiction is there.
Yeah.
I find I can't not put it there.
Yeah.
It's just me. I think logically. I put logical things in. So everything internally consistent and logical, but it's really about the people.
Yeah. Cool. Now, what about alternate worlds? Tell us about alternate worlds. Is it still running, alternate worlds?
Oh, yes.
Yep.
Writers Victoria has, every now and again, has a... course on science fiction or speculative writing, and I'm a couple of years after Clive died, I thought, right, this is my year, more for me. I'm going to enroll in some courses, so I enrolled in Paul Collins' speculative fiction course.
Yeah,
and it started out with about 20 people, and we would gather together every month or every second month, and we would all critique each other's work. And we got on, there was a core of us who were quite serious about our writing. We really did intend to publish.
Yeah.
Others were there just simply because they were on a course and they were enjoying themselves. And Paul is a really great guy. And, but there was a core of us, about 8 or 9, who said at the end of the course, this is working for us. We get on really well. We are helping each other.
Yeah.
We'll continue it on our own. And that's how Alternate Worlds came about. And there's still 5 of us who form a strong core and a couple of extras who come in every now and again. And they're always welcome because, they are part of the group. And, we've now got editors in our group. We've got a Varuna scholar in our group. Everybody bar one has now been published.
Yeah.
it is a very strong and strongly supportive group. We like each other. We talk about each other's successes. We commiserate on each other's failures. And we help, you know, we still read each and critique each other's work. And that's still the core, you know, to get together.
Great.
So it's still a wonderful thing to be part of.
Wonderful. Now, as a rider with hearing problems, are there any challenges or benefits to your condition? And do you have any advice for other riders with hearing problems?
Well, the hearing problems and hearing impaired and deaf, I call myself hearing impaired because I have tinnitus. And technically I'm not deaf, I can hear a bit. But, you know, shorthand for deaf, you know, hey, speak louder, I can't hear you, I'm deaf, works a hell of a lot more than I have tinnitus and I can only hear the bass range of notes because the top range of notes is hidden by the tinnitus. Just saying I'm deaf is works so much easier. But, you know, as a writer, I haven't always been deaf, so I do remember what things sounded like long before I lost them.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I'm talking about writing about music, I can still remember, even if I can no longer hear it completely. And so as a writer, when you're thinking about what's going on, you're daydreaming about it, you're dreaming about it, you're working out what's happening, it's a solitary thing. You don't have to hear.
Yeah.
You don't even have to see or feel or touch or smell or anything because it's all in your head.
Yep.
You don't need any external access. And even when you start writing, you know, there are all sorts of technologies around now that overcome being blind or you know, I'd sit down and I type.
Yeah.
But, you know, even if I was blind, there is now technology to overcome that. So as a writer, you can afford to live your life without all your senses.
Yeah.
It gets difficult, though. You know, when I was earning a living, I was in an open plan office and there was noise all the time.
Yeah.
You know, someone would ring me and I'd be going, can you speak up? Can you speak up? Because I couldn't see them. I couldn't get any visual clues. You know, there was no body gestures. There was no context.
Skype.
There was nothing.
Yeah. As compared to video calls, so we're using Skype. So that's...
Yes.
That's good.
I like Skype. It means I can use my hands.
Yeah. It's good to have the visual cues, I think, for everyone.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was much harder, especially in meetings. You know, two people would be speaking. I couldn't work out a word of what anyone was saying in a meeting. And it really held me back because, you know, I could never take the next step of becoming a manager because I could never run a meeting.
But you still do panels at conventions?
Mostly what I do at conventions is one-on-one chats, you know, over coffee. I do turn up to things like the masquerade and that because I like looking at the costumes and you know, I like congratulating the winner and stuff like that. But every time I go into a panel item or, you know, a proper talk, a keynote speech or whatever, I position myself in the front row so I can see their faces.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there's nowhere in the front row, I put my hand up and say, hey, handicapped.
And can I have a seat? Yeah.
And I don't do, you know, it's been a long, 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 long time since I volunteered for panels.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if someone in the audience stands up and asks a question, I can't hear them. I don't have the visual clues. I don't have the context that the question is coming out of. I don't have anything that I can put together to work out what's said. So someone, you know, when I'm the one at the front doing the talking, someone else has to be there to be my ears.
Right.
So, you know, I don't do...
Yeah.
I don't volunteer for being the upfront person.
It would be interesting to see how the community could support you further to do things like that if you wanted to.
So far I've done pretty good relying on friends and
avoid
attention. Mind you, if I become a successful author, I might have to do more than that.
Oh, you have a team then following you around and doing everything for you, I imagine. So what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I was going to submit one of my stories to Hatchet because they're reading this month. But when I actually read the actual guidelines and eligibility criteria, and my son has just noticed I'm talking on Skype and tiptoed away. But yeah, I was going to give gin joints to Hatchet, but Hatchet only want YA.
Yeah.
And you've read Neil by Mouth. It's not YA.
No. That said, I would have read it. I would have loved it when I was like 13. So.
Yes, I know.
But, yeah, but you're right. It's not. It. I guess marketed YA. Yeah. There's sex. There's violence. There's gruesome. There's horror. It's great.
Yeah, so, yeah, there's not a lot of sex, but it isn't gratuitous. It's absolutely essential to the plot.
Yeah.
You know, when he's talking, when Patricia is trying to seduce him, it really cements in his mind what's wrong between human, for him, what's wrong between him and human interrelations. It really, it brings home to him just why, how he really feels about Dranda. You know, just how essential she has become to him in his mind. You know, he finally understands. And the relationship between him and Shell, the canteen manager, it's another step in the rehumanization of him, learning to connect again with human beings after what he's been through. So it's absolutely essential in both of them are essential in his progress for healing and for accepting who and what, it, you know, what he is and what he wants out of life. They're not gratuitous. They're essential to the plot line.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't dwell on them. I don't, you know, turn it into porn or anything. I put in what's necessary for the plot.
Yeah, it's nice to have freedom from those boundaries, I suppose, where you can, like, from the Y, it's different to YA, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things I have said to people about YA and one of my frustrations with it is you can terrify a child so much that they're scared to go to the toilet at night in a YA, but you can't tell them about how wonderful it is to have a relationship with somebody.
Okay.
So I get very frustrated with the YA guidelines because it's stripping an essential part of humanity out of the equation.
Okay. So YA guidelines don't want to explore sex, is that?
Yeah, then you're not allowed to explore sex.
Interesting.
You can have a platonic relationship.
Okay.
You can have a snuggle and a kiss.
Yeah.
But you can't go all the way.
And but like some YA books explore things like rape as well, but
yes, you can't talk about the rape itself.
Right.
Talk about its after effects. You can talk about how it happened, how it came to be.
Okay.
But you can't talk about the horror during the event.
Righto.
So
it's interesting.
It comes cleaned, you know, whitewashed, because.
Yeah.
How can you really explain the after impact when you can't explain the horror at the time?
Yeah.
And essentially, Ale is raped. This is how the baby arrives. He's essentially raped.
Absolutely.
But I cut down on writing about that. My publisher wanted me to write that in more detail until I pointed out that, in its essence, it's a rape.
Yeah.
I do not want to traumatise my reader too much.
Yeah.
So, but apart from that, you know, since Hatchet weren't going to accept gin joints, on Wednesday night I took advantage of now I have to look up my notes. On Wednesday night I offered it to HarperCollins.
Okay.
HarperCollins have what they call Wednesday page.
Yeah.
every Wednesday they will read. They'll take unsolicited manuscripts. This is what I mean by Hatchet is reading unsolicited manuscripts. So, so on Wednesday night, so I sent gin joints to them on Wednesday night. Now, gin joints is a space opera.
Yeah.
It's, again, science fiction. Everything I write is science fiction. It's a lot longer than Nil by Mouth. Nil by Mouth barely made the novel category. It's only 42,000 words.
42,000? Okay. I really like that size. I love it. I love short novels.
Gin joints is more than twice that size. It's 102,000 words. And that's after I edited it and tried to get rid of the guff. But it's also much more wide-reaching. It deals with the two main... First of all, it's written in with two main protagonists in first person. Like Nil by Mouth is first person singular, one protagonist.
Yeah.
Gin Joints is two protagonists, again, first person singular, and I swap between the two of them. One of them is a prisoner of war who's a prisoner of war to the aliens on the, you know, the war starts out on an alien planet and he's a prisoner of war, and it you know, he's reached rock bottom. When the story starts, he has no hope of ever having a future, of ever having anything. He's just simply going through the motions. He's obeying his master.
Yeah.
He's doing what he can, but he has no hope left. The other protagonist is on the run from her government. She's an alien. Again, human-alien interaction. She's on the run from her government because at some stage in the past, and I don't want to give away too many spoilers here, she did something which really annoyed the king.
Right.
And the king wants her dead. So she's packed up her child and run. And she's still running 10 years later. And she's also reached the point where she can't see anywhere to turn. She stumbles into Sam's gin joint, hence the title, and sort of says, "Can you help us?" She cannot see anywhere to go. She has no idea, you know, she doesn't even know where her next meal is going to come from at this stage because she's totally surrounded by people chasing her.
And she's on the run with her child.
With her 10-year-old child.
That's awesome. Yes. How often do you find a mum on the run with their child when I kind of think for so many of us, with our kids in our lives, we do have to take them along a lot, don't we?
She couldn't leave them behind.
No, you can't leave them behind. I agree. But in some of the stories, they do leave the baby, I'm going to war. But I think taking the babies.
The baby is, in fact, the reason she's on the run.
Yeah.
And if she left him behind, they would leave her alone.
Right.
They'd kill the child.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds really good. So what's that one called again? Gin Joints.
Gin Joints.
Gin Joints.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So we'll look out for that.
HarperCollins on Wednesday night.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yes, thanks.
Is that one? Now, last of all.
The one called Trainer.
Trainer?
Which is 92,000 words, so Nil by Mouth is a bit of an exception.
Yeah.
But Nil by Mouth is as long as it needed to be. You know, I tried a couple of times to expand it, you know, maybe bring it up 45,000, because 45,000 is more respectable than 42. But there really isn't a wasted word in it. There really isn't anywhere you can sort of slot in extra without destroying. It's a very tightly composed story. I could have expanded some of the scenes here and there, but it would have taken it away from the impact of that scene.
Yeah.
And so I'm very pleased with Nil by Mouth because I think it is a very, very good story. And you obviously like it, so I'm pleased with that too.
I liked it.
But Trainer, I'm offering to Penguin, who read first week of the month. as part of that, they
open submissions.
Yeah. Yeah, they read. They call it the monthly catch. So I'll offer a train all to them next week.
Oh, great. Awesome.
And then I've got lots of other stories ready that aren't ready to go, which yeah. I'm still working on. And if none of them happen, then, well, you know, in 2 or 3 months' time, there'll be something else.
So, you're a prolific writer.
Yeah, I write. Yeah. Even in the days when I was, you know, full-time mum, full-time worker, full-time carer for my dying husband, and, you know, while Clive could, Clive helped. But, you know, about 3 years before he died, almost full-time care. Yeah. When you're doing all of this stuff, you can't do a lot physically. You can't write a lot. But that doesn't stop it happening up here.
Yeah, so you're still free to write about it.
There's all this stuff just waiting to come out.
Now, you have a mononym. Can you tell us about your name?
Well, I've been calling myself Lindsay since I was 13, 14, signing it on all my paperwork and everything. And then I got my first job, and even at university they accepted that Lindsay was what was my name. But then I got my first job and they insisted that I use my legal name. And by this time I was 18. And so I walked in to a solicitor's office and sort of said, want to change my name? Did it. So I walked back to the office after lunch and sort of said, that is my legal name. You have to accept it.
And they accepted that?
They didn't want to. The banks didn't want to initially either, but unless they're using American software, because America doesn't accept mononyms.
Right.
America insists that you have at least two names, if not more.
But Australia does.
But Australia allows mononyms. They're quite legal in Australia. Having said that, I can't log into DHS, the federal DHS, because their website insists on two names.
Right. Oh, the Department of Health Services.
Yes.
DHS,
the Victorian Department of Human Services, does, because they had me saying, hey, mononyms are legal, you've got to accept us.
Yeah.
But the federal DHS doesn't.
Come on, federal DHS, get your act together. Okay. Well, I think that winds up our interview. So thank you for talking to Galactic Chat today, Lindsay.
Thank you.